Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for October 9th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the organized way your DNA gets folded up in your cell's nuclei. Electrical currents flowing forever, even in non-superconducting metals, and personalized treatments for cancer. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story linking sugar for kids with violent behavior as adults, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
If you were to stretch out the DNA that's in any one of the trillions of diploid cells in your body and line it up end to end, it would be around 2 meters long. Of course, all that DNA stays folded up, mostly, so that it can fold and unfold a little bit at a time, and so be accessible to the transcription factors, translating the instructions in the nucleus for the rest of the cell to use. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Yob Decker and colleagues report a new method that has allowed them to characterize how all that folding works, at least down to the resolution of a few hundred thousand to around a million base pairs, a base pair making up a rung in the DNA ladder. The researchers aren't quite to the resolution they would like, because most really interesting things, such as gene regulation, happen at a lower length scale, up to around about 100,000 base pairs. But they report as DNA sequencing technologies improve, it should become increasingly feasible to get increasingly better resolution and so make more sense of the internal workings of the cell's nucleus. I spoke with Decker from his office at the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester.
So the three-dimensional folding of chromosomes has been a very long-standing question, because chromosomes are extremely long molecules. They can be several meters long, yet they have to fit inside a really tiny cell nucleus. And you can't just fit it in any random way. It can't just be jammed into this small space. It has to be organized in such a way that the cell can still read and interpret the genetic information. Yet, despite the fact that we know it's very important, up to now we have not been able to really study the three-dimensional folding at the resolution that we'd like, the resolution at which we can see individual genes being organized in very specific places.
Up till now, what's been the main working hypothesis for how chromosomes fold?
There's a lot of controversy in this field about how chromosomes can fold. And this has something to do also with the fact that there were no methodologies to study the precise folding of chromosomes. So polymer models have been used in the past because, in fact, chromosomes can be viewed as very long polymers. And from polymer physics, we know how you can fold polymers in small volumes. And random walk polymers have been very popular to describe some aspects of chromosomes. But in order to really fit chromosomes in tiny volumes in an organized way, people have come up with a variety of models. One common theme of these models is that they rely on the formation of chromosome loops. So if you can coil and loop chromosomes, you will get them really tiny and packed really densely. And the problem has been in the past that it was impossible to see such loops. So it does all a lot of speculation about how chromosomes can fold. On a much higher level, at the level of a whole nucleus, it has been known for a long time that chromosomes form independent bodies, so-called chromosome territories. So we know chromosomes form independent territories in the nucleus, but the internal organization of chromosomes has been largely mysterious.
So what then distinguishes the model of how chromosomes fold borne out by your team's work compared with other past models?
Well, the models that have come out of our work confirm some of the observations that have been made previously. What I just referred to, the chromosome territories, are clearly visible in our data. What our data add to our understanding of chromosomes, which is something that we didn't know before, is that chromosomes are folded in a very dense manner, but in a conformation that's entirely new. It's called a fractal globule. So it is the folding of the chromatin on top of itself, forming a small globule. And then you have a string of these globules. They fold in the same way again to form bigger globules. So you end up with a globule of a globule of a globule of increasing size. But if you would take a section of it, it would just look like a miniature reiteration of that same conformation. This is a polymer conformation that has been proposed to occur many years ago, in fact, for chromatin, but has never been observed. In our data, we can see that that conformation is formed, and it's a very, very dense conformation in which chromatin is folded in a way that is completely knot-free, meaning there's no knotting, there's no entanglements, there is no way that the chromosome is topologically mixed up. The chromosomes are very neatly organized, and this is a really new insight. The biggest advantage of this is that if you have two pieces of the chromosome that are relatively near each other on the linear chromosome, they will also tend to be close together in the fractal globule. So two things that are far apart will also be much far apart along the linear chromosome, will also be far apart in the three-dimensional structure.
How is it that you and your team mapped the chromosome folding?
What we did in the paper is to develop a new technology that allows us to visualize the three-dimensional organization of chromosomes. This methodology builds on previous technologies that have been developed, in part by my own lab. So previous technologies were based either on microscopy, which is low resolution, at least relatively low resolution, and you can interrogate only a few loci at a time, meaning you can only look at a few loci inside the nucleus and determine their three-dimensional position. Whereas we would like to do that for the entire genome at high resolution. Other methods involved methods based on 3C technology, which is a method that we developed a number of years ago. And this method relies on cross-linking of interacting genomic segments and converting them into unique ligation products.
So the parts that are touching but aren't necessarily connected, you found a way to get those two to link together.
Yes. An alternative way of looking at the three-dimensional structure of the nucleus is to ask which parts of chromosomes are touching. These could be loci on the same chromosomes or loci on different chromosomes. And if we could do that for the whole genome, for every little segment of the genome, we can determine what other parts of the genome are near it. You can use that data to get a three-dimensional view of the nucleus. What was done in this paper is to develop a methodology that allows you to do just that, where we take cells and we cross-link cells with formaldehyde, which will link all these interacting chromatin segments. When two things are near each other in space, two segments of the genome are near each other in space, we can link them chemically. And in our next step, we can convert those cross-linked segments into unique ligation products that can then be sequenced on a deep sequencer. And it will tell us across the genome which pairs of loci are near each other in space.
Now, with this dependence on sequencing, how robust is this model then that you construct? Are there any concerns about the accuracy of sequencing getting in the way?
It is certainly true that by sequencing, you have issues with how accurately you can determine which part of the genome you actually sequenced. So what we've done here is we sequenced relatively long stretches of these DNA molecules and were able to map a significant fraction of them uniquely back to the human genome. The ones that we couldn't uniquely map back, of course, we have left out of the analysis.
Because there's already a very, very complete gold standard human genome mapped.
This analysis definitely requires the availability of high confidence and very good and accurately mapped genome sequences.
So any additional insights beyond this proposed fractal globule model for how chromosomes or the whole genome is organized?
One thing we are very excited about is the observation that the entire genome seems to be segregated over two types of spatial domains. With this I mean, if you look at a chromosome, we find that some parts of the chromosome are in one spatial compartment and some other parts are in a second compartment. These compartments differ in activity. So one compartment contains all the active parts of the genome. They're all clustered in a single compartment, whereas the other compartment contains all the parts of the genome that, at least in these cells, seem to be not active. With this, I don't mean that if you look at a nucleus, it is split in two. The left half has all the active chromatin, and the right half has all the inactive chromatin. It's not like that. It's more stochastic, where you have local clustering of all active chromatin in one area, and it's spatially separate from inactive chromatin nearby. So it's much more mixed still, but active and inactive chromatin tend to be spatially separated. And this is seen across the genome. Also, actually, this is also apparent in interactions between chromosomes, so that active regions on one chromosome like to be near the active regions on another chromosome.
Joop Dekker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joop Dekker of the University of Massachusetts Medical School is co-corresponding author of a paper on the folding principles of the human genome. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, recently announced that it plans to expand its role in controlling greenhouse gas emissions. The agency also recently released its plans for research on the potential risks of nanomaterials. Here with more is PolicyForm editor Brad Weibel.
Nanomaterials are characterized by their extremely small size, as tiny as about 1/10,000th of the width of a human hair. The research in the EPA plan will focus on nanomaterials in wide use, such as carbon nanotubes, which are used in sports equipment and electronics, and titanium dioxide, used in paints, cosmetics, and sunscreen. The research strategy will also include analysis of ways to mitigate any risks that are discovered. EPA is undertaking a larger effort to rewrite how it evaluates, regulates, and enforces the use of potentially harmful chemicals, which until now have been based on the more than 30-year-old Toxic Substances Control Act. This will involve working with Congress on new legislation. In other news, EPA announced steps to expand its role in controlling greenhouse gases. The Clean Air Act, which for years has guided EPA regulation of many conventional pollutants, was ruled by the Supreme Court in 2007 to apply also to greenhouse gases. Though regulation of greenhouse gases under the Act has yet to take place, EPA announced draft rules that would require large industrial facilities that emit at least 25,000 tons of greenhouse gases a year to obtain construction and operating permits. To receive permits, facilities undergoing construction or major modification must use best available control technologies and energy efficiency measures to minimize emissions. EPA will be accepting public comments on the proposal.
That was PolicyForm editor Brad Weibel with the policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. In any lump of metal, say the coins in your pocket, most of the electrons are moving around at about, on average, 1% the speed of light. If they were all traveling in the same direction, you'd have an electrical current. But, of course, they're actually going in every direction, so the net current adds up to zero. But as Jack Harris and colleagues reported in a paper in this week's Science, by turning that lump of metal into a ring or loop, and by applying a magnetic field through the ring, all of that motion gets modified in a slight way so that the net current flowing around that circle is non-zero. I spoke with Harris from his office at Yale University.
We've shown that the lowest energy state of a metal ring actually has an electrical current flowing through it, and that's true even if this metal ring has a resistance.
Now, I thought that this kind of persistent current was something that was unique to superconductors.
That is the amazing thing. So persistent currents are familiar in superconductors, but quantum mechanics is very clear. It says that any time you confine electrons to a ring, the lowest energy state in general does not have zero current. And that's true even if there is electrical resistance. The absence of electrical resistance in a superconductor makes the persistent current easier to see in a superconducting ring. But even if you just have a plain old metal, copper, something not superconducting, quantum mechanics is very clear that just the fact that it's a ring means that the lowest energy state will actually have current flowing through it.
So why has it taken so long to confirm this, up till now, theoretical quantum mechanics prediction with experimental evidence?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of an interesting story. The theoretical prediction seems to rest on extremely basic fundamental ground. I mean, really, actually, at almost an undergraduate level, would you say that the ground state of electrons confined to a ring has to have a current. It requires a little bit, I mean, it actually requires quite a bit of clever insight to realize that if your metal ring has resistance, it doesn't destroy this current, and it requires still more insight to calculate exactly how much that resistance would change the current. It doesn't suppress it zero, but it does change it somewhat. But the basic predictions seem to rest on very, very solid ground. And I think as a result, the original motivation to experimentally verify it was not to test some, you know, deep, poorly understood mystery, but really to do an experiment that showed a textbook quantum effect, albeit a very, very counterintuitive one. And what happened is that the first experiments that tried to measure this ground state current found very, very strange results. And in fact, the first bunch of experiments found results that seemed to be at odds in many respects with the simple theoretical predictions, and even to some extent between the experiments themselves. And at the end of that day, at the end of, you know, the series of experiments, we were left with this huge question mark. It appeared, given the disagreement between the experiments and theory, and even between the experiments and each other, that there was something going on in the simplest possible electrical circuits, just a ring of metal. I mean, that is the simplest possible electrical circuit. No transistors, no superconductors, no batteries, no exotic materials, nothing. And yet when we went and measured, not me, but when people went and measured the most basic property of this most basic circuit, i.e. what's going on when it's at rest, at its ground state, they found results that seemed to be in, you know, strong disagreement with the predictions of theory and even with what other experiments had found. And that is really what started, I would say, the mystery in this field. Nobody knew if the experiments were missing something or if the theory had missed something important. And that's the big question mark that we set out to try to address with our experiments.
And so has your team's work built on previous approaches, or did you try a novel approach to making this measurement?
Some of both. I mean, the actual means for detecting the current was completely different than what people had used before. But many of the basic ideas underlying the experiment are exactly what people had looked for before. The means for detecting the experiment was something incredibly simple. It's in fact the basic operating principle of any electric motor, which is that if you have a loop of metal with electrical current flowing through it, then if there's a magnetic field nearby, that loop wants to align itself with the magnetic field. And this is what generates the torque in an electric screwdriver or something like that. We're trying to use that exact same effect, albeit writ much smaller. We have our little ring, and we suspect there might be a current through it. So we apply a magnetic field and then try and see if, you know, we know that we're applying a field, and so if there's any current in that ring, it should have a little torque exerted on it. And we measured that torque with an extremely sensitive torque meter, if you will. And that's the micromechanical cantilever, which formed the heart of the actual detector in our experiment.
And what then is the current, this resting state of this simple ring?
You know, it's actually, it's not that small. It's about a nanoamp. If you take a simple metal ring, gold, copper, in our case it was aluminum, and if you make a loop out of it that's about 1 micron across, which is small on everyday scale, but very, you know, typical for the size of wires you might find in a computer chip, then once that ring is at temperatures below about a Kelvin, the ground state of this ring has a current flowing through it of about a nanoamp. And nanoamp is small, but current of that size could be measured, you know, by the handheld ammeter that, you know, most electricians would carry to work every day. This is actually a pretty decent sized current on the electronic scale of things. The thing that made it so difficult to measure is that this is a current which will never flow through your ammeter. An ammeter is a thing where you have to break the circuit and slip the ammeter in there. This current will only live in that little metal ring, and so you have to detect the current without breaking the ring open. That's what made it hard. But at the end of the day, what we found was that the current that we measured was extremely well described by the simplest complete theory of how electrons flow through a disordered metal ring.
Now, you said aluminum. Is that superconducting?
Yes. So all the low-temperature physicists in your audience immediately had flashing red lights go off in their head saying, wait a minute, this guy is telling me that you can have persistent currents in resistive metal, but I know aluminum is a superconductor. And it's true that under certain circumstances, aluminum is a superconductor, but we apply such a large magnetic field to our sample that the aluminum is driven into its normal state. The superconductivity is suppressed. We're measuring in a magnetic field, which is something like 30 times the magnetic field you need to kill the superconductivity. So aluminum, when you apply a big magnetic field to it, is as normal a metal as, you know, gold is, or copper, a real non-superconductor.
How reliable is your team's measurement?
You know, I'm extremely confident in it, and my confidence is based on the fact that we were able to measure a bunch of different samples in which we were able to vary basically every parameter, almost every parameter that you can vary that, you know, theory says should be important in determining the properties of the current. We were able to vary the size of the rings. We were able to vary how much magnetic field we applied to them. We were able to vary the temperature they were at. We were able to vary whether we applied the field normal to the ring, through the ring, or in the plane of the ring. And as a function of all of those parameters, we found signals that varied as one would expect according to the theory. And I have to say, when we started this experiment, I did not understand the theory well enough to know what to be looking for most of these quantities. And so this is not so much a case of finding the needle you were looking for in the haystack as cataloging the entire haystack and then going back through it and trying to see if it made sense.
Jack Harris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jack Harris of Yale University is senior author of a paper on persistent currents in normal metal rings. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. The transition from a normal, healthy cell to one that is cancerous typically requires a series of mutations in the cell's DNA. Finding out what those mutations are means taking the cancer cell's DNA and genotyping it. Already, scientists have come across some of these mutations that lead to cancer and have developed drugs that specifically target weaknesses in those particular cancerous cells. Now, as scientist Jocelyn Kaiser reports in this week's issue, such targeted drugs are having some success, and major cancer centers in the United States are getting ready to genotype every patient's tumor. The hope is, of course, matching patients with drugs already developed, but also contributing those genotypes to a catalog of mutations, and so better understand cancer's particular genetics.
Stories about a new approach to treating cancer, especially lung cancer, researchers are now beginning to look at the genetics of a patient's tumor and identify genes that can be matched up with a drug that works on tumors that have that gene. And they have started to routinely genotype, as it's called, the tumors of patients to find drugs that they can be treated with and also to find patients for clinical trials. The current direction in cancer treatments is to use what are called molecularly targeted drugs that home in on a protein or other flaw in the cell that drives cell growth and stop the cancer from growing that way.
So on the road then towards a personalized treatment for cancer.
Right. It's personalized because instead of giving the patient the same drug that everybody with that type of cancer has, they will give the patient only a drug that only some fraction of patients with that cancer would need because their tumors have this particular genetic change that makes them susceptible to that drug.
What kind of success rates are researchers getting with these targeted drug approaches? If you've got that mutation, the drug works?
It depends on the cancer and the drug. The most successful one is for a form of leukemia. The drug is called Gleevec, and it has been very effective, although patients do eventually develop resistance to it, but there's another drug coming along to deal with that. So Gleevec, I don't know what the cure rate is, but the survival rate may be 70%, while if you had standard chemotherapy after 3 years, you know, 20% of patients would still be alive, but if you have a special drug, maybe it's 70%.
So a potential patient, a person right now going into their doctor, they can expect to have their cancer genotyped, or is this something that at this point, state of the art, they still have to ask for it?
Yeah, for certain types of cancer, it's standard to genotype. For example, if you have breast cancer, they will look to see if your tumor is expressing a certain protein called HER2. And if it is, then they will give you a drug called Herceptin. But if it isn't expressing that protein, I think you'll get standard chemotherapy. That test is covered by insurance. It's standard to test for it. Others are just beginning to make their way into the doctor's office. And still others are really at the stage where the drugs are still experimental, so you would not get this drug normally if you go into your doctor's office.
patients usually at this stage are looking for anything? Is it this something that they can enroll in a clinical trial at this point? Can patients take steps to enroll themselves in a clinical trial?
Yeah, patients can. I mean, I don't really know how it works normally with a doctor, if the doctors tend to push people towards clinical trials. I know that researchers think there's a shortage of cancer patients in clinical trials. It's only a small fraction of people with cancer who will go into a trial. If a patient wants to find a trial, it's very easy to find them to go on the web. There's a database called clinicaltrials.gov, and they can find them. And I think if they qualify, they seek it out. And if they can travel for the trial, then they can do it.
Are there efforts then underway to match every mutation with a drug and create truly personalized medicine on an individual scale?
Well, it depends on what you mean by every mutation. Right now, there something like 15%, 20% of lung tumors have one of, say, seven mutations that if they have this particular mutation, that's driving that tumor to grow, and there is a drug that you can treat it with. But other tumors don't have any of those seven mutations, and they have such a huge number of mutations that there's no obvious way to treat it and no drug for treating it yet.
So at this point, knowing which mutations are the most prevalent would really be an advantage to researchers. These seven in lung cancer, what steps are underway to catalog them?
Well, there's a big project funded by the National Cancer Institute and another part of National Institutes of Health, the Genome Institute, to systematically find mutations in the major cancer types and build a catalog so that they're trying to, for one, find a lot of these mutations are known already, but they're trying to find new ones and also get a handle on how common they are. If you look at a whole bunch of cancer patients, what portion will have X mutation? And they're looking at not only mutations, but other genetic changes like missing pieces of chromosomes or extra pieces and changes on the surface of DNA called epigenetic changes that can also affect cancer risk.
Now, are these mutations that they're cataloging just at the diagnosis stage? You said a lot of these cancers seem to mutate and their cancer becomes resistant to the drug. Are there second stage genome cataloging projects going on too?
Well, this big cataloging project is not working sort of directly with the patients. They're working with samples that are put into storage. Those patients aren't going to be treated based on what that cataloging finds. But included in the samples, I think, are not only patients who haven't gotten any drug yet, but also patients who have. And so that, in the case of glioblastoma, which is a kind of brain cancer, led to some interesting new information last year about why patients develop resistance to a certain drug for that cancer.
So these samples aren't linked to the patient on an individual basis?
With the Genome Atlas, I'm pretty sure they are not linked to the patient. I think they are collected from the patient, donated for research, and the results are not given back to the patient later on.
And the records aren't going to then follow the patient around. His or her medical record isn't going to say, this patient has such and such cancer.
Not with the Genome Atlas, but with this other project that we are talking about where cancer centers are routinely doing this testing on the tumors of patients. Yes, the idea there is that it will become part of their medical record. So, yeah, there would be privacy concerns, just like your medical information on any other part of it. You want it to keep it private. Hospitals and doctor's offices have to keep it private.
In either case, in the Genome Atlas Project or in these other cancer screening tests, genotyping tests, are they routinely covered by insurance?
For the Cancer Genome Atlas, that is a research project, and there's not really any direct connection with the patient, so insurance isn't really relevant. It's covered by, you know, the money for that research. But the genotyping that would be done on an individual patient, that is kind of a gray area right now. The cancer centers that are doing this, they're testing for some mutations that are covered by insurance right now, like that one I mentioned earlier, HER2, is an example of one that's covered by insurance.
For breast cancer.
That's for breast cancer, yeah. But some of the others are new. They're not covered by insurance yet. But one possibility is that because they're testing for the ones that are covered and it doesn't really cost any more to test for the others, that insurance might cover the costs, maybe most of the costs, or even all of the costs, because when you add more mutations, the cost doesn't really go up that much.
What is the typical cost for such a genotyping of cancer?
Well, I heard about two numbers when I talked to researchers for my story from the two main cancer centers that are doing this, and one said their costs are around $2,000, and they still don't know yet whether insurance will cover that. And then the other center said theirs will be $500 to $1,000. And right now, getting a test for one of the genes that are covered is maybe $900. So you can see why, you know, possibly it could be covered by insurance.
Put that into perspective for me. How much of a cost is that relative to other standard care?
So one researcher told me that $2,000 they're charging is really know more, maybe it's less, I don't know, than a magnetic, an MRI, which, you know, people have done all the time.
Beyond then the creation of this database and the scientific challenges of successfully targeting a cancer with a drug, are there any other hurdles to overcome before truly personalized cancer treatment becomes widespread?
So if by truly personalized medicine you mean comprehensively checking for all these genes in your tumor, right now only big academic cancer centers are doing that. It's not something you could get at the average doctor's office. The hospital wouldn't be able to do it. But within a few years, there will be test kits available probably to do it. And there's also further down the horizon, the idea of the $1,000 genome, where you could sequence the entire person's genome or their tumor's genome for $1,000, and then you get all this information. But we're still a long way from that, for one thing. It's just a huge amount of information, and nobody's really figured out how to boil it down in a way that a doctor could easily use.
Jocelyn Kaiser, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Science's Jocelyn Kaiser writes about personalized treatments for cancer in this week's issue. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about sugar as a drug in kids that leads to violent behavior when the kids grow up. Dave, I imagine this is going to have some real effect on whether parents are giving their children as many sweets.
Well, it could, Rob. This is a very controversial study. And the study purports to show that children, specifically 10-year-olds, who eat more sugar or more sweet foods than average, grow up to be more violent people.
Where did they get this data?
Well, originally, it's a very large data set. The researchers looked at 7,000 people, and this is in the UK, children born in 1970. But then they narrowed that down a lot, and they found that 38 of these people, so now we're really narrowing down that 7,000 to 38, by age 34, 38 of these people had committed at least one violent offense. And then they looked even closer at these 38 people, and they said, okay, well, of these 38, there are 28 of them whose data we can really rigorously analyze. So now we've gone from 7,000 people to 28 people. So we're dealing with a very small sample here. But what they found was that 69% of these 28 people had eaten what the researchers called confectionery, which basically covers candy and anything sugary, nearly every day during childhood. And that's versus only 42% of people that hadn't committed a crime but still ate sugar daily. So that's actually, you know, it looks like a pretty big difference in percentages.
Now, I imagine there are a number of confounding factors here. What are some of them?
Well, the biggest issue here is that this is what researchers call a correlative study. This is just a correlation. There's no direct evidence that eating sugar actually makes you more violent. The researchers are just showing that people that tend to eat more sugar as children tend to be more violent. But there are a lot of confounding factors, as you say. I mean, for instance, people that tend to eat a lot of sugar tend to have lower education levels, too, and lower education levels during childhood have been linked to more violence in adulthood. So that could be the real factor. But the researchers say they really tried to control as best they could for a lot of these confounding factors. And they say even when they tried to remove as many confounding factors as they could, they were still seeing this correlation. So there may be something to the data.
Is there something about the drug sugar, as it's being called, that researchers think would actually lead to a predisposition towards violence as an adult?
Well, one expert says that one possible mechanism is that a connection has been shown between a predilection for junk food and hypoglycemia, which involves drastic changes in blood glucose levels, and these themselves have been associated with more aggressive behavior. So there are possible biological mechanisms that would explain this. Again, though, it's a very small sample size, so you don't want to draw too much from just this one study. But if you're interested, there's actually a very lively discussion about the merits and potentially lack thereof about the study in the comments section of this article, and you can check that out online.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, the next two stories have to do with longstanding mysteries in two different fields. And the first one is sort of a historical mystery, and it involves ancient Rome. And the question here is, how big was the population of the Roman Empire in the first century BCE? You know, in the first century BCE was a very tumultuous time for Rome. The Roman Republic was ending. Julius Caesar was assassinated during this century. In about 28 BCE, a Roman emperor named Augustus decided to conduct a census, figure out how many people were Roman citizens. And the census takers came back and they said, we have about 5 million citizens. And that was actually a big surprise because this represented a tenfold increase in citizens over the last censuses that have been done a century earlier. And so for 2,000 years now, researchers have been wondering, what accounted for this huge, seemingly huge population explosion?
So they found some new evidence to shed light on it?
Well, they did. And researchers were working with two possible hypotheses. They were saying, well, maybe it was just simple population explosion. I mean, 100 years is a long time. People are breeding. You know, maybe that really just accounts for this tenfold increase in citizenship. But others have said, you know, this first century BCE was a very tumultuous time. There was a lot of civil wars going on. And, you know, when you have a lot of wars, you have a lot of people dying. And if a lot of people are dying, then you would expect, you know, citizenship to go down, probably not to go up. So this other group has postulated, well, maybe Rome started granting citizenship to women and children, which it hadn't done before. And all of a sudden, obviously, if you're bringing a lot of women and children into the fold, the citizenship numbers are going to go way up. But surprisingly, there really hasn't been any strong evidence for either of these hypotheses until now. And the evidence in this study has to do with buried treasure. What it is coin hoards. During this time in the Roman Empire, when there was a war going on or, you know, a big conflict going on, a lot of times people would bury these big stashes of coins. And the idea was, you know, they didn't want these coins to be found by other people. You know, and if they went into battle and they came back alive, then they would dig up their coin hoards and they would, you know, have all their money back. But if they died, you would basically have all of these coin hoards that were buried and never recovered because the people weren't around anymore to recover them. So the researchers said, if we can find a lot of coin hoards around the first century BCE, that means these coin hoards weren't dug up, and that means that a lot of people were probably dying, and that would support this hypothesis that the rise in Roman population can only be explained by Rome extending its citizenship to women and children and perhaps doing other things that would have boosted its numbers that have nothing to do with the population growing.
But how do you assess how many coin hoards you have to find before you can say a lot of people are dying?
Well, it has to do with some very complicated modeling. And these researchers actually have data. There's people that go around, you know, a lot of these sites in Europe with metal detectors and find these coin hoards all the time. So there's a lot of data for where the coin hoards were found and, you know, what's the approximate date of the hoards. And the researchers collected all this data and they fed it into the model. And what their model tells them is that about 100,000 people died during civil wars during this first century BCE. And because of that, because so many people were dying, that really supports the theory that the Roman citizenship didn't really explode during this time because of a population boom. It probably exploded because the Romans were counting a lot more people, a lot of different types of people than they were before.
But of course, there could be another interpretation too.
Exactly. And speaking of correlation, again, this study is just a correlation. There's no direct evidence. They just have this sort of really intriguing new way of tackling this mystery that researchers really haven't been able to figure out.
Okay. So last one. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, this is the second mystery I have got for you today. And this mystery is about Saturn's moon Iapetus, which is a very strange moon.
What makes it strange?
Rob, this moon is kind of like a yin-yang symbol in space. And what I mean by that is half of the moon is very dark, almost pitch black dark, and the other half is very bright. That's very atypical to see for any sort of body in the solar system. You know, things tend to be much more homogeneous. And so researchers have been wondering, well, what caused Iapetus to have such dramatically opposing colors on its surface? And it turns out the blame has to do with a dirty ring around Saturn, a ring that had never been discovered until now, and a ring that turns out to be the largest ring in the solar system.
Wait, so the ring is coloring the moon somehow?
Exactly. And here's how it works. First of all, about the ring, the researchers used this infrared satellite called Spitzer, and they were able to discover this ring around Saturn, which had never been seen before because it's very faint, but it's also very broad. This ring is actually composed of a dozen what astronomers call satellites, and these can include moons and other small bodies that orbit Saturn. And what happens is asteroids and comets smashed into these satellites, and that kicks up debris from these satellites, and this debris hits more satellites that causes more debris to fly around, and you've got all this debris flying around, which is colliding with each other and colliding with other satellites, and it sort of grinds itself down into this very fine dust over time, which is why this ring's been very hard to spot, because this dust is so fine. But what's very close to this ring is Iapetus. And because it's the largest body that's close to this dusty ring, and it has one side that's always facing this dusty ring, this side is essentially getting coated with dust. And so essentially, Saturn's giant ring is giving Iapetus a dirty face. And it's surprising, you know, researchers hadn't been able to figure this out until now, but it took some very sophisticated satellites and interpretation to figure out exactly what was going on here.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a couple stories about animal parents and their children. One story is about how baby bats mimic their fathers. They copy their father's territorial songs. Another story is about how macaque moms speak Gaga to their babies. So just like human moms sort of use this sort of infant speak and they speak in these high tones, it turns out rhesus macaque mothers do the same thing. And on the policy blog, we're following a number of stories. One this week about the future of European science, where things are going over the next two decades. And swine flu, as you may have noticed, is making a comeback in the headlines. And we're right on top of that. We're looking into this week about early vaccination programs and how successful those have been. And what are going to be the next steps going forward in terms of dealing with swine flu, both in the U.S. and abroad. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the October 9th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.